somebody loves you, it's no good unless he loves you.
Frank Sinatra starred in the film The Joker is Wild, based on a book by Art Cohen. Kirkus Review tells the story this way. The book is a biography of Joey Lewis, the Jewish boy whose luck got an assist from his determination, who was not made bitter by body blows and physical handicaps. His name as an entertainer started in Chicago in the 20s, where he was the mobster's comic, and their darling, who was also their target, to the tune of severed vocal cords and a slashed face when rival gangs claimed him. In the scene we are imagining here, June Krause is reading that book, and she gets to a particular paragraph and stops. She reads the paragraph again, and again, and she's astounded by what she's learning. And she calls her son Joe, desperately asking him, "Is it true that your grandfather, my father, was killed by a gangster? Is it possible that he was a gangster?" Today, October 15th, 2019, Cornell University Press will release Joe's answer to his mother's questions. It's The Kosher Capones, a history of Chicago Jewish gangsters. Spoiler alert, no, and yes. Dr. Krause is chair of the Department of English and Theater at the University of Scranton. He is co-author of An Accidental Anarchist, and he has just been nominated for a Pushcart Prize for his essay, My Mother is a Cat, in the online edition of Under the Sun. Cornell University Press is issuing the book today, and tomorrow evening, Dr. Krause will be in Kingston for a book release event at the Friedman Jewish Community Center that is free and open to the public. In advance, Joe Krause had a chance to stop in at the VIA studios to talk with us about his quest.
Before you even tell us about the book, introduce us to your mom. How do you talk about your mom?
I have to smile when you ask, because she was nuts. Completely nuts. She died only about a year and change ago, so it's still actually very fresh. And when I first think of her, it's sort of different couple lenses at the same time right now, because for many years she suffered from Alzheimer's advanced, so she lost herself. And most of the years I was writing the book, of course, I was recovering a story that she never knew in the first place. But at the same time, she had forgotten virtually everything she did know at one point. So that was a strange experience, kind of talking to her. And in the year plus now since she's been gone, one of the gifts that you get when you lose someone you love very much who's suffering from Alzheimer's is you recover earlier iterations of that person. And so increasingly, the mother who comes to me when I close my eyes, that is when you ask a question, tell me about your mother, increasingly she's the kind of woman who would run out the front door of the house and shout at people who drove past too fast, say, "Slow down," with a waved fist. Or I come from a small town, Granville, Ohio, where Denison University is. And there was a tradition of people who were progressive in their politics, sort of angrily, not angrily, actually quite friendly displaying their positions. And so you'd have over time people who were very close to me, next door neighbors and dear friends, and my mother among them, who would stand on corners, you know, protesting the war, one war or another. I mean, I remember the Vietnam protests. I'm old enough to remember the very end of those, and straight on through to the Gulf War and Iraq. And it was a very funny combination, because you'd have these people holding signs, and in other contexts, people come by and angrily, you know, wave a fist or flip a finger. But in this small town, everybody would do it all the time. So, you know, those people who were happy with the way the politics were going would laugh sometimes, and they'd wave, they'd say, "Up yours," but it would be a kind of a friendly "up yours" back and forth. And my mother fit into that context perfectly. She was always sort of making pseudo enemies. And anytime, if I brought a friend to the house, there was always, the first thing she would do was find a way of teasing that person. So probably my best friend throughout high school, the first time I brought him over, he said, "What are you having for dinner?" She said, "Well, what do you like?" And he said, "I like everything except rutabaga." And 7 years later, if he was coming to dinner, we were having rutabaga. We weren't really, of course, but that was how she explained it. He'd say, "What's for dinner?" She'd say, "Oh, rutabaga." And it was just, she never forgot that. And so this sort of wonderfully kooky person, and I had to tell her that she was the daughter, really, of a gangster. She had some sense of, some limited sense she knew. But that to me is sort of the striking thing about this story, is the degree to which it's been forgotten in the space of a single generation. So I literally had to tell my mother that her father was not killed in a shooting involving Dean O'Banion in Chicago. She didn't know one way or another. She read it in a book, and that's really where my whole project began, that this book, The Joker is Wild, which was a bestseller and eventually made it a movie starring no less than Frank Sinatra. And so in that book, at least in the paperback version of it, it records that my grandfather, her father, was killed by this notorious Chicago gangster named Dean O'Banion. And she didn't know. And that's really where my story begins. She said, "Joey, is this how my father died?"
And her father died when she was, what, two, you said?
About two, yeah. So she really didn't know him. So it's an experience of recovery of so many stories.
She was curious. She wanted to know about what that would have meant at that time, right? She wanted to know what it would have meant to have a dad who was a gangster.
Absolutely. She wanted to know, and she also didn't want to know, which I think really is that intervening generation's position. There is a kind of a threat to some of these stories. I don't mean that she was in any way physically at risk, but you don't want to hear that your father was a murderer or a bootlegger, or, I mean, there are worse things. You know, I'm fortunate that I can say my family's gangster connections weren't involved in prostitution, but that was a big part of the world in which they operated. And so certainly some of the people with whom they were allied were. Certainly, that's really where the Capone gang got started, was in prostitution. Gambling and prostitution, but you know, that's how the Italian gangsters of the time looked down on them early.
What's fascinating for us in this telling is that we learn not just about your grandfather and his circle and the various factions and so forth, but we do learn about how it was stratified or divvied up and the first iteration and then the Capones and how that was all sort of worked out territorially and why the Jewish gangster world didn't in Chicago prevail as it might have in others. And that's very interesting. It tells us so much, not just about Chicago, but the demographics of the country at the time and how shifts were taking place. So you really had to sort through so many stories and so much data. Tell us about how hard it was. You had wondered why nobody'd ever done this before.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. That was such a generous reading. I'm so grateful to the way you talk about that, because there is a sociological element to what's happening here, in the sense that you begin, when prohibition starts, it's almost like somebody firing a gun at the beginning of a road race. And all these people just go. Suddenly there's this opportunity for vast illegal income. And some people have a head start. Again, what becomes the Capone gang is really very much involved in gambling and prostitution. Some of the Irish gangs have got advantages in that they have connections to the police more thoroughly established than other groups. Other groups are sort of senior people, like my own family were people who were involved in gambling in the Jewish community. So they had that kind of advantage, that head start. Others, though, were just crazy aggressive. You know, you'll get someone like a Meyer Lansky, who was a young man in his late teens. He and his partner, Benny Siegel, and others, just, they're more violent than other people. And that you have all these different communities who are in that first initial wave, they're in conflict with each other. Very rapidly, it evolves into a series of small to mid-sized gangs, with some of the larger ones floating around. And in Chicago, the proto Capone gang becomes, under a guy named Frank Nitti, essentially, becomes the largest group. And Nitti, famously in Chicago, stitches together what comes to be known as the syndicate. And so any gang that's of a sufficient size is able to be part of it. And in some respects, it's like a guild. They are competing with each other, but more dramatically, they're keeping out the small-timers who might nibble away at what's happening. As that syndicate settles in, Frank Nitti comes into conflict with this guy named Dean O'Banion. And O'Banion, in fact, takes out my family at one point. And their fight escalates. And in fact, Nitti is then shot. O'Banion is shot. It's a back and forth. And the culmination of their conflict is what we know as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And the St. Valentine's Day Massacre is not the end, but the beginning of the end of real conflict within that. And the syndicate emerges from that as essentially one gang institutionalized. And then what I was able to trace in the second half of the book is that as a syndicate, it emerges into what in Chicago they like to call the Outfit, which is a wonderful, mysterious kind of group. And the Outfit absorbed even those non-enemy, non-centralized gangs that were part of the syndicate. I mean, I hope that sounds like an appealing story, but it's also sociology. And so my challenge in telling it is to keep the dry quality of that made into characters and to give names and faces to them rather than just sort of this succession of, that's fairly standard in organized crime thinking, but I don't think has ever been played out in the, certainly in the context of Chicago's smaller gangs, certainly not their Jewish gangs.
And what's wonderful is we will have introduced you as a professor of English. And so you study, you know about character and creation of character and the importance that is in terms of drawing us in and telling a story.
Yeah. And for me, one of the definitions I put forward of a gangster is that a gangster is somebody who is in control of the stories that are in circulation about him. And so I love the example I love to use is that blood is really expensive. I don't care who you are as a gangster. If you kill somebody or have somebody killed or have somebody beat up, you run all kinds of risks. You create enemies. You create clues, evidence that people can use to prosecute you. Far more effective than beating somebody else up is to have somebody make way for you on fear of your beating him or her up. So the ultimate gangster is not someone entirely anonymous, nor is he, and it's almost always a he, somebody who is obviously guilty. It's somebody who walks the line between those two stories. Someone who walks up to the velvet rope and the person says, excuse me, sir. And that's precisely what you want. So I love to look at the study of organized crime from a literary perspective and to see that that's the nature of the history. It really is a series of competing stories because whoever is most able to persuade other people of his or her preeminence is preeminent.
Who's a character in world fiction who would fit that description? Well,
I mean, I think first of the great Gatsby, who you've got Gatsby himself, of course, he's mysterious. We don't know who he is. On the one hand, we have the notion that he is just a thug. On the other hand, we have a notion that he is somehow great in that larger spirit. But when our narrator is sort of disinterring the stories, he comes across his mentor figure, Meyer Wolfsheim. And Wolfsheim is asked the question, did you start him? And Wolfsheim's answer is, start him? I made him. And in fact, that's what Wolfsheim is doing. And there are stories in circulation about Wolfsheim. When we first meet him, our narrator thinks, is he a dentist? Because he's got human molar cufflinks. And Gatsby says, no, he's the man who threw the 1919 World Series. In fact, in real life, if you care, the story about Arnold Rothstein, the man on whom Meyer Wolfsheim is sort of most evidently based, and there's evidence even from F. Scott Fitzgerald that he was thinking of that, it's actually not clear that Rothstein did throw the 1919 World Series. And the theories that I find most striking on it are that it's a couple of his lieutenants who were able to, simultaneously, get baseball players involved in the fix because they assumed that these people, through their association with Rothstein, had the power to make it all happen. So Rothstein himself could say, I didn't have anything to do with it. And he was never actually convicted. The evidence goes both directions, but it's stories within stories. Right. These are all characters who are so largely forgotten, even in Chicago. As I say, so much of what strikes me about this story is the degree to which we erased it semi-consciously, sometimes even consciously. We refuse to tell these stories. The Yiddish term is shanda. There's an embarrassment. And I suppose it's true of any ethnic community that feels at some point threatened. You want to put your best face forward. So to put forward those things of which we would be ashamed is to put all of us at risk. So there is, in fact, there's a much that is a shanda about these figures.
The other thing is we go to your skills as a teller of stories, and you liken it to bread making. And I think it's wonderful because it's so apt. And when you go through, you can see what you're doing. You're weaving. Tell us about that, how you lay that out.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. You know, I did ask the question for years, why hasn't anybody told this story? And sometimes the answer that I would get even from professionals, agents, who would say, well, there's no story there. And one person finally said, well, who would Robert De Niro play? Who who would Joe Pesci play? And of course, now we have it coming out in our local Irishman film that's going to be coming out. But it made me realize in the case of the Jews, I was able to find essentially it turns on the murder of a man named Benny Zuckerman, who takes over from all of these disparate gangs on Chicago's West Side. He's the lieutenant to a rival of my own family. But in fact, he makes his headquarters in my family's old restaurant. So he's kind of an inheritor of the two largest sort of Jewish gangster groups of Lawndale. He takes over. And he's the leader of the independent Jewish gangsters at the time. This is 1944, when a Jewish member of the syndicate of the outfit, who's on the cover of the book, Lenny Patrick is involved in the murder of Benny Zuckerman. And that's the transition from what I would call the independent Jewish gangster into the Jewish element of organized crime in Chicago being subordinated to what then becomes known as the outfit. So all that's taking place. But as I was imagining, how do you tell this story? And when I think of the Italian-American story, which dominates the Chicago version completely, it's everything is Capone-centric for a lot of good reasons. I mean, he really pulls together the central gang and he inherits the coalition. So he succeeds Johnny Torrio in this gang that's now pulled together almost the entirety of the city, except for the one large Dino Banyan, Bugs Moran, Northside gang. And with St. Valentine's Day Massacre, they basically take out that power. And so you have this very clear story, and people tell it and tell it all the time from the very beginning of that gang up until almost to today. I mean, if you go on Wikipedia, they'll identify the man they think of as the leader of the Chicago organized crime, the Chicago Syndicate, and it goes straight through. The Jewish story is completely different, and I was struck by how it's broken and then connected. You'll have one character leading to another. Even the Jewish community moves. You know, it starts in what's called Maxwell Street, which is the Chicago analog of the Lower East Side, the sort of point of settlement. And then they move to the West Side, called a neighborhood called Lawndale, Greater Lawndale, Jewish Lawndale, which I think would be pretty much the equivalent of Brooklyn in the New York context. It's a second landing place, still tightly packed, but much greener in terms of its opportunities and much more open to being remade in a new way. So Lawndale's, the signs in Lawndale are in Yiddish as much as they are in English. And you look back and see it's just sort of extraordinary. And the Jewish community moves from Maxwell Street to Lawndale. And then in some respects, like the New York story as well, they move out of that area as well and more into the North Side, where I knew my grandmother on the straight side, on the legitimate side, although even that was kind of iffy. Particularly my grandfather, my father's stepfather, was a restaurant owner who actually owned the restaurant across the street from my mother's uncle. And they were opposite each other and were in the Chicago Crime Commission papers, had little bits and pieces on my father's side of the family as well as my mother's side of the family. So we've got gangsters all around. But in any case, there's that story in the Italian-American version that is so clearly drawn from the earliest days of the gang when it was gambling and prostitution all the way through its, you know, casino era running Las Vegas into what it is today, which is by most accounts just a fragment, a residue of what it was. And it's all there in a straight line. And when I was writing the book, I thought that reminded me of Italian bread, right? It's just a straight, long piece. And I even like the notion that it's kind of scarred along the line, right? You make the little cuts so that the crust doesn't completely break. Whereas the Jewish story is much more braided, much more woven, which fits nicely with challah, which is how we make our challah. So it's a softer version.
You give us facts, but again, you create these real people. And I think we're movie and old TV fans. Yeah. The nicknames, could you believe some of them?
No. Yeah, it's crazy. I have sort of at times compiled a top 10 list of my favorite nicknames.
What are some of them?
The one, there's an associate, I'd have to look up. He was fairly small time. I believe he was more or less a syndicate hanger-on. His name was Charlie Monkey Face Genker. And I have what I think may be the only extant photo of Monkey Face. He's not in the book. I'll have to share it with the world some other way. He's not even that funny looking. I don't know what the point is. Maybe his parents thought it was cute.
Without falling to stereotypes, yeah. Is there something that characterizes your understanding of Jewish gangsters that has its roots in Jewish culture?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who have tried to make that case. Mm-hmm. There's one of the earlier studies on the Jewish gangster in America touched on Chicago a little bit. And I was in contact with him when he was doing his book several years ago. It's called, great title, it's called But He Was Good to His Mother, The Lives and Crimes of the Jewish Gangsters. And you'll get some of them. And it's a fairly compelling case at a certain point that because Jews were a threatened minority, that you had a tradition of Jewish gangsters who were standing up within the community. And so what that author does, I think pretty effectively, is show during the World War II period how Jewish gangsters took a real lead across the country in fighting anti-Semitism, but really overt Nazism in the States. And so there are stories. There's a well-known Los Angeles gangster from that era named Mickey Cohen, who was a very high-profile figure even into the 70s. He figures into a lot of L.A. Confidential. That's kind of he's actually the story of L.A. Confidential is set into motion when Mickey Cohen is arrested and the rackets are up for grabs. And in that story, it's the police who try to move in on Cohen's rackets. But Cohen was actually a Chicago kid who moved out to L.A. and he was a brutish, physical guy. And according to But He Was Good to His Mother, the police who were opposed to Nazis, to Bundists, if they arrested German supporters, would throw them in a prison cell with Cohen, who would just take skulls and crash them together. So there's some of that. And it was sort of too good to be true when I first came to it. And I really spent years being skeptical about it. But the leading figure in the sort of Jewish gangster community in Chicago who fought like that was really my great uncle. As I say, it was too good to be true. I questioned it every step. But I mean, researchers other than me did really extensive oral histories, finding out. And Davy Miller was his name, and he owned the first major gambling place. Actually, I'm sorry, second major after Putty Annixter. He owned the second major Jewish sort of restaurant gambling place in Lawndale. As the Jews were moving there, he was very early. And I point out that the Jewish gangsters helped pioneer this Jewish neighborhood because there were threats at all times. And you get lots of stories about people who would say, hey, you know, we're being threatened, and they would come and defend them. You know, years ago, I sort of the example I gave was that when Benny Goodman was carrying his instrument to, it's called Hull House in Chicago. It's a cultural institution that protected minority ethnics. They call them settlement houses. Really kind of an early form of social work, but it was an applied form of social work. When Benny Goodman took his instrument to Hull House to get lessons, it was Davy Miller and those guys who kept him from getting beat up. That may be a bit of an exaggeration. I don't know the specific, but it's clear that there were tough Jewish guys who were fighting back like that. And I do think it's a really interesting claim to make, but to your larger question, is there something distinctively Jewish in these guys? I don't think so. And I push against it because there have been a lot of people who've sought it out.
What did you learn about the Miller brothers and the family?
Well, it's fine. I mean, even mentioning that it's only as you're asking me about it that I realized the decision, it was my small semi-conscious, that in the introduction and conclusion, which I understand as essayistic, as creative nonfiction, and in those, I refer to them as my grandfather, my great uncles. But in the body of the book, they're the Miller brothers, and it's Davy and it's Maxie. And Hershey. Hershey was a classic gangster racketeer type of the real, like, original Scarface kind of thing. And there really is, it amazes me, but he was driving in his fancy, you know, DeSoto or Edsel or whatever it was, Cadillac, some car, not far from Wrigley Field, where I lived for several years. And he's literally driving in Chicago, and he sees the kind of guns sprout out next to him, and they're shooting at him while he's driving, and it's like a 1924 chase. And so he was early involved in the cleaners and dyers racket, where you would basically tell dry cleaners, instead of charging a nickel per item, you got to charge 10 cents per item. And 4 of those cents come to us. So there is some incentive. The dry cleaners do make a little bit more, but most of the additional money comes to the organizer, who then turns around and beats up other people. But very rapidly became a battle between gangsters, and Hershey was an independent trying to make it in what was essentially a two-player. The major leaguers were the Northsiders and the Capone gang, and he held on pretty well to the point that, and again, it's crazy how public some of this stuff was. He sold out for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and kind of then got shoved aside.
It is the stuff of many movies, Joe. Why do we love these stories?
We do love to tell those stories. I have spent many years thinking about it, and I can never settle on a particular reason. Part of it, I think, is it is a reminder of a kind of fundamental brutality of human culture, right? We are a civil community, and we are a civil community built on top of a fair bit of violence. In this case, I think, particularly with the Jewish gangsters, it's so much against type, so much against stereotype. There's a guy who wrote a very well-known book called Tough Jews, a man named Rich Cohen. His book is all about the New York Murder Incorporated. And I'm uncomfortable with what he's saying, but it's nice that someone else has laid out the extreme position. He said, I was tired of being thought of as weak because I was a Jew. And, you know, that was just sort of the implication, right? Who ever heard of a Jewish sports star? Now, it's actually changed since he and I were children. I mean, now we have some big ones. But in some respects, certainly for Rich Cohen, it was an antidote to the notion that you come from a weak people who were purely victims. And so he takes more comfort in the notion of us as victimizers than I would like. I think there's an interesting in-between. It sounds like an academic answer, too soft, but part of what I admire is that this was part of the way in which we negotiated a kind of immigrant experience into full acceptance. It's nuts not to say that immigrants were gangsters. I think that that's a very dangerous claim to make. But that the violence that was associated with much of this experience created a space within which many people who had no power, had no opportunity, did have power and did have opportunity. Again, I find that story fascinating and one that we haven't told effectively. And given that we are, as has always been the case in the United States, looking at generations that are new to this community, I think to forget the way we experienced it two or three generations ago is dangerous and certainly not fair to those who are experiencing it right now.
Joe Kraus, chair of the Department of English and Theater at the University of Scranton, is co-author of An Accidental Anarchist. He's just been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. And today, October 15th, 2019, Cornell University Press is issuing his new study titled The Kosher Capones, A History of Chicago Jewish Gangsters. Now, today is the release, and tomorrow is the release event. Tomorrow evening at the Friedman Jewish Community Center, just across the river from Wilkes-Barre in Kingston, there will be a book release event that is free and open to the public. And if you need more information about that, it is on the web, friedmanjcc.org, FRIEDMANJCC.org. The event gets underway at 7 o'clock. Again, a book release event, October 16th at 7 p.m. at the Friedman Jewish Community Center in Kingston, across the river from Wilkes-Barre, free and open to the public, friedmanjcc.org, friedmanjcc.org.